From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast adding fuel to your knowledge about forest fires. Today's episode is called Up in Smoke. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing well. What are we talking about today?
Today, we have joining us in our studio, Dr. Bill Flieger from the Environmental Studies Program here at Linfield College. Bill is an expert on the issue of forest fires.
Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Chad. Good to see you guys.
Tell us a little about the history of forest fires in the West.
Wow, it's...
In 30 seconds or less.
30 seconds or less. And it depends upon what historical time period that you're looking at. But
I left that intentionally vague, actually.
Yeah. So fire's been a part of the natural landscape in all parts of the world. But in the Western United States, natural fire has existed in the form of lightning ignition since we came out of the ice ages, and vegetation existed here in this part of the country. So those lightning-caused fires sort of roamed the landscape unchecked. And those fires intermixed with fires that were also set by Native Americans for a variety of purposes, hunting chief among those, but also for facilitating travel and for implementing warfare, and then also for facilitating harvest of native plant species. So fire existed on this landscape for since the landscape has been here. And so what has happened since this area was settled by European immigrants is the fire regime that had existed for the period of time that Native Americans were here and being stewards of this landscape, it began to change to one that was dominated by a different fire regime and different fire practices that Europeans brought with them. Also, the fire practices changed and industrial logging came to be an important part of what was happening in this landscape, and that added large amounts of slash and accumulations of fuel. And then you also had different sources of ignition in the form of steam locomotion and steam machinery that that added additional fire to the landscape.
Was fire at this time, was fire really understood as a natural part of this landscape, or was it just seen as this thing that was burning up a potential resource that was unfortunate and didn't really have a place within the natural cycle of the forests in this part of the world?
Well, it was mixed, and that it was mixed in part depending upon the region of the country that you lived in, particularly in the South. There was in the Appalachia as well as in the loblolly pine region in the South, fire was seen as an essential tool to manage forests because you had to burn them because they regenerated by fire.
So can you clarify about the regeneration? What do you mean by that?
Well, loblolly pine really requires fire for regeneration and growth. It's a fire-dependent species. And so there was always had been some forestry use for the purpose of generating pine for timber harvest. So there was not necessarily a sense of understanding fire ecology in the way we do today in terms of the importance of species that are dependent upon fire and also the ecology and how natural fire regimes sort of keep the landscape in check and in a certain type of condition. But there was the awareness of fire as a useful tool for land management, getting rid of garbage and debris, and hunting. It was a primary use of fire for rural folks.
I would imagine that our listeners might not be aware of this term that you used about a fire-dependent species. There are certain species that depend on the presence of fire. And can you tell us a little bit more about species that are fire-dependent as well?
So lodgepole pine is a classic example. It's a higher elevation species that we have here in the Pacific Northwest. Its cones are what's called serotonous, meaning that it takes high-intensity fire and for the cones to be able to open and release their seeds. And it also tends to grow in very thick stands of regeneration that occurs only after intense fire. And so, in essence, so lodgepole grows really thickly and densely, in part to encourage its reproduction, because it's going to depend upon an intense fire coming through that area in another time period in order to facilitate regeneration of that stand. And so this is a species that actually thrives on a high-intensity wildfire regime that happens infrequently, but when it happens intensely. And it facilitates the regrowth and the release of the seeds from their cones and also the reestablishment of the stand.
So you're saying that it will grow densely, mainly so that if you had sparsely populated, then you'd have a fire maybe on this one tree, but it would not spread to other ones.
Right.
And then the cones have to actually open up and release their seeds.
So, and sorry to jump in, but an adaptation like that, that depends absolutely on fire, seems to suggest that fire has been a part of this system for a really long time for an adaptation like that to develop.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
So, yeah.
And so it must have been very frequent and very fairly normal for it to do that?
Yeah.
Or what's sort of the time scale that we're talking about here? Like, would you have to wait until these pines are full adults and making seeds and really thick and then clear that out so that the next generation can come? Or is it like every year, every other year, something like that, you kind of burn it out?
Well, this brings up the whole concept of what's called a fire regime, is that landscapes have evolved to burn in fairly typical patterns, left to their own devices, in terms of both elevation and distribution across the geographic landscape. So ecologists, when they talk about how fire affects the landscape, they tend to talk about a fire regime, meaning that certain areas of the landscape burned at a certain periodicity. So, for example, shrublands, areas that are dominated by Manzanita ceanothus, ponderosa pine, typically have a higher frequency of burning, but a lower intensity. So they burn more frequently, but because they burned more frequently, they tend to burn at a lower intensity. And as you move up in elevation and you have different types of species dominating the landscape, as you get up to the elevation of like 5,000 feet where lodgepole pine exists, that has a low frequency, but it tends to be a high intensity event. And so it doesn't maybe happen for once between 80 and 150 years, but when it happens, it usually takes the whole stand or a whole patch of that stand.
Okay.
And so you have different areas of the landscape that have evolved to have different fire regimes. And so that's how we understand and distinguish between different plant communities and how they interact with a natural fire environment.
Okay.
So that gives us, I think, a good sense of what the landscape is like out here, just kind of on a natural fire cycle, these different fire regimes, different species are adapted to different frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you mentioned, the native populations would burn frequently as well. But then you mentioned that with European settlers moving in, that completely changed the situation. And at least out here in the West, we're talking primarily the last 100 to 150 mm-hmm. years.
Correct.
When that really would have started having its force. And so in what way has that affected the frequency of these wildfires? Are they more or less common or no difference, or is it hard to say?
Well, it varies, again, according by the time period. So initially, when the Europeans took over, I guess, stewardship of this region, the transformation in the landscape was fairly significant within a really short period of time. So if you remove that annual firing of the Willamette Valley, forests began to crop up almost immediately in those areas that were not burned. And so initially, again, there wasn't anybody running around putting out fires. So when you got natural ignitions or escaped ignitions from settlers, those fires burned unchecked. And so initially, during the period of time of transition until we began to pursue an active path of fire suppression, fires were more frequent on the landscape and probably more intense because you had new fuel in terms of regrowing forest, you had slash in terms of logging and timbering operations, and so there was actually more fuel and more fire on the landscape. And so the regime shifted during that time period.
What's the time frame? Like, what years are we talking here about?
Well, I think Native American practices were probably predominantly ended by the 1860s.
Okay.
So from the 1860s, 1870s until fire suppression practices began to be implemented in the 1900s, 1910s. So you had a period of time there where fire was probably more frequent and more intense, and there was more fire on the landscape. And then eventually those fire suppression began to become more effective because we had roads, we had access, we had more manpower available to address those fire suppression activities. And then in the aftermath of World War II, when we had all of the surplus military equipment that was hanging around and we had people that were trained in parachuting, we began to apply those tools to the fire suppression project and became exceedingly effective at it. So when you could parachute smoke jumpers into remote wilderness areas to put out a lightning-caused fire, then you could stop that fire from spreading. And so kind of the unique thing about fire as different from like other natural events like floods, hurricanes, is that we can't control those events, but any fire can be extinguished with hand tools if you get there quick enough.
Right.
And that's what the deployment of military equipment, airplanes, helicopters, repellers, you know, smoke jumpers, allowed us to begin to do. And I have a really interesting piece of data from a friend of mine who was an ecologist on the Siskiyou National Forest. in southern Oregon. And he has a very interesting graph that shows the number of fires acres burned per year on the Siskiyou National Forest in southern Oregon. And then right at the time that the smoke jumper base was put in that region, fires were effectively suppressed for a period of like 30 years. And so the ability to be able to get into the backcountry quickly and put those fires out really substantially reduced the fire frequency there. But what that created is a situation is kind of like putting your thumb on a fire hose. It's, you can stop the flow for a little while, but the pressure eventually builds and ultimately is going to explode. And that graph also shows the increased number of acres burned in a single year shot up after suppressing those fires for so long, and the acreage of fires has been larger ever since. And so the consequence of being able to suppress those fires has led to the accumulation of fuel, which when they do happen makes them all the more likely to burn at a higher intensity and higher severity than they might have been had they been allowed to burn on their own.
So that's interesting. So there was this delay, you're saying, that policies of like, oh, we should put out all fires, and that sounds really smart and great. But then there was about a 30-year delay, you said. And then all of a sudden, it's just enough stuff built up that
you could no longer, it's going to burn. And it's just a matter of timing. Fire's always been sort of a weather-driven event. So it always takes the right combination of weather to be able to push a fire. But so as you've got fuels, what it's heat, oxygen, fuel is the fire triangle. And it's weather topography and fuels that really sort of just define how a wildfire behaves. And
so weather being both sort of a short-term and a long, like if we have a really dry summer, then it's more likely to spark.
Exactly.
But then also with that fire, if it's windy or something like that,
yes.
Right?
Yes. If you have winds or the right type of weather conditions, fires can explode and move rather quickly a lot across the landscape.
And so you said that since late 1980s, is that right? 1987 or something, that the frequency and intensity of wildfires has been going up a lot.
Well, I can show you the graph that sort of explains the relationship, but there's a very definite gap in between the establishment of the smoke jumper base versus the next large amount of acreage that would burn. So
it was
typical that like 100,000, 80,000 acres in that area would burn each year or across multiple years. But then once the smoke jumper base was installed, you could see it sort of flatlined. The amount of acreage burned in the years after that is very minimal until...
Okay. Yeah. And then so the number of acres that have burned in wildfires has stayed at kind of a higher level since that time. Is that fair to say?
Or is it just noisier? You have a bunch of single events that burn a lot at a time, but then it kind of...
And is this despite similar levels of fire suppression efforts, or have fire suppression efforts changed in some way since that time?
I can give you some sense in terms of the total acreages that burn on an annual basis, as well as the costs that are associated with starting those. And the National Interagency Fire Center, they track the number of fires every year, as well as the number of acres and the amount of suppression costs that are associated with each of those fires. There's a lot of variability in there, but when you take like 10-year averages, you can begin to see some interesting trends. And so, for example, in 1994 to 2004, there was a 10-year average of 3.6 million acres that burned each year in the United States. And then if you take the time period from 2008 to 2017, the 10-year average was 5,159 million acres. So you can see a fairly substantial increase in the 10-year averages. So the trends are fairly clear that we're experiencing more acres that are burning each year. And then the suppression costs are also have been going up to where now the Forest Service in particular spends over half of their annual budget on firefighting.
Okay. Yeah. So it's that initial period of successful fire suppression did exactly what you said. It sort of created this, I don't know, this backlog that, no pun intended, that basically needed to be burned through.
In essence, by suppressing fires, we're contributing to the buildup of fuel, which sets us up to accomplish the very thing that we're attempting to prevent. This idea that we don't want to have fire in the landscape, but the more fuel that accumulates, the more likely it becomes and the more intense those fires tend to be.
But this is only in the lower elevations? Are there more big fires with the lodgepole pines that you mentioned that had a frequency of, I mean, they naturally would go longer than 30 years anyway.
Right. So, you know, yes, it does vary according to the elevation and the geographic location. So Southern Oregon being hotter and drier, you have different fire regimes that are tend to be more frequent. And then, you know, if you get into the higher elevation cascades, those are also longer interval fire regimes where the frequency is lower and intensity tends to be higher.
So it sounds like maybe you shouldn't have like a national, one single national rule then, right? I mean, it sounds like you should say, all right, well, in this region, maybe we should try to put out the fire as soon as we can. But in other places, we should let it burn. And maybe other places, we should intentionally set it on fire or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what we know we need to begin to do. And we've needed to begin to do that since primarily the 1960s. Forest managers, the foresters began to initiate research that was associated with trying to better understand how fire was a natural agent in the landscape. And so that was kind of the birth of what we know as fire ecology. And so this was really sort of epitomized or came to public attention when the Yellowstone fires, I don't know if you're familiar with Yellowstone National Park burning, I think it was 1988.
Yeah,
I remember that well.
Yeah, and yeah. The National Park Service had let some fires persist because they had adopted a policy of allowing fires that were naturally ignited to continue to burn, and those naturally ignited fires burned together with some that were caused by humans, and so a large portion of Yellowstone National Park burned. And the Park Service was widely criticized for allowing that to happen. And so nonetheless, they've stuck to their guns in substantial ways and sometimes had some serious consequences to pay for that. There was a famous fire, the Los Alamos fire, that was an intentionally prescribed burn. It was an intentionally started fire by the Park Service that got out of control and burned through Los Alamos, New Mexico, and threatened the nuclear lab down there. And so, but there has been this awareness that fire needs to be accommodated in some ways on the landscapes, and that we need to begin to do to allow potentially some fires that don't burn. It's called wildland fire use. So when naturally ignited fires that don't pose a threat to humans or infrastructure, all agencies now have a policy of allowing those fires to burn if they are burning within a specific prescription. So if the weather's right, if the fuels are right, if there's no threat to resources or infrastructure, then those fires are tolerated. But it's a real risk if you're a fire manager. You know how to suppress a fire, but you don't know what the weather's going to be like a week from now. And so there's a real risk that fire managers take that they will be blamed for allowing a fire to burn that then gets out of control and causes damage. And
right. So it sounds tricky then. You want it to be... It's like Goldilocks, right? It has to be just
yes,
just dry enough that it'll burn, but if it's too dry, then it gets out of hand.
Right. And so in order to implement a policy of wildland fire use, fire managers have to put in place and have pre-approved prescriptions for every place on the landscape that they want to allow wildland fires to exist on their own. Another way that land managers and fire managers talk about this is what's called fire regime condition class, and this gets to the idea of thinking about how different areas on landscapes have different fire regimes and how far out of whack they are from that what you would normally think of as their typical fire regime.
Okay, sure.
And so how many fire cycles those regimes have missed. So even if it's a more frequent fire regime, if it's missed two or three cycles, that becomes a problem. And so if it's in one or two, if it's in a range of one or two, then you can potentially go back and burn those areas. But if it's in a two or three, sometimes you have to go in and do manual treatment in those areas to remove the fuels before you can get it down to a level where you could safely burn it. And so
you're saying that if it's only one or two cycles, the fire hose is not just going to burst at that point.
Right.
But if it's more than that, now you've got all this extra fuel. So if you try to light a fire, it's just going to get out of control and you can't handle it.
Right.
So you're saying that people have to go in and like manually just dig up limbs and leaves and...
Particularly so you have the fuel loading is what it's called, the amount of dead and dying material that's accumulated on the forest floor, as well as what are called ladder fuels that allow fire that would normally stay on the ground to be transmitted into the canopy, to climb up into the canopy.
And so what's that mean?
If you get a fire in the canopy and it spreads from canopy to canopy, that kills every tree in that stand. And so if you're wanting to have an overstory remain, then removing the ladder fuels that allow the fire to climb from the forest floor up into the canopy is an important way to prevent that. And then you also want to separate the crown so that there's some distance between crowns so that fire won't touch from crown to crown to crown and run through the entire stand and take the entire stand out.
Would this be like some lower branches on the trees?
Lower branches on the trees.
And so you want to kind of cut those down so that, so like a healthy forest that you would have, you wouldn't see anything until it's way, way up, like several tens of feet up in the air. And so you're saying at that point, you could burn stuff on the ground and it's just going to stay there. So it's not that dangerous.
Right.
But you're saying if you do light on fire the entire tree all the way up, that kills the tree entirely.
Right. And if you have the weather that will move that fire through the canopy, then that entire stand will be killed. And so if you want to reintroduce fire into that site, you have to prepare it first so that you won't have that negative outcome. Mm. And so that's one of the complicating factors in terms of trying to reintroduce fire in these areas is that it's often very expensive to actually go in there and have to treat fuels first and then apply fire.
Mm. And so is that why if you were a logging company, you wouldn't really be that interested in trying to go into some of these areas and take out, I don't know, say 20% of the trees if you also had to deal with a lot of reducing ladder fuels and...
Right. And this gets into the policy questions of how we should deal with this. But yes, so the types of things that you would normally think of that are necessary to remove to allow a stand to accommodate fire in a more natural way are the sort of the non-commercial materials that are not very valuable. So it's generally smaller trees, dead and downed material. And so from a commercial standpoint, that's not something as a logger that is very profitable for you. Logging tends to do is remove the biggest and best trees because those are the most valuable and profitable. But if you're managing from a fire standpoint only, you tend to remove the smaller, less merchantable materials, and there's very little commercial viability of that type of project.
So how do we need to be thinking about wildfire now with concerns about climate change? In what way does climate change feed into either forest fire intensity, how we ought to be thinking about living with or dealing with forest fires?
Well, temperature, the increase in temperature and climate change, as well as the cycles of drought that we experience in various parts of the United States, really do substantially affect and have changed the fire regime.
You used have changed. Does that mean that we are already starting to observe this change?
Oh, yes. It's very clear from the trends. We're seeing bigger fires, longer fire seasons, more intense fires. And that's partially attributable to an increase in global temperature. So I think we're looking now at a degree of warming in our region of the United States. And so even though on any given day, 1 degree doesn't seem like a big deal to us, as it significantly affects the behavior of a fire once it starts. And so, you know, that increase in temperature contributes substantially to the difficulty in controlling fire once it ignites.
Okay.
I have a question. Can I shift gears just slightly?
Let's do it. Sure.
Okay. So, and feel free to cut that out.
If we need a transition, that's a good transition.
Okay. So another big issue out here in the West is water use and water policy. And I'm just wondering if water use policy and decisions about water use are related to forest fire acreage burnt or intensity or anything like that, or if that's kind of a separate issue entirely.
There's a couple of connections between the fire regime and the hydrologic regime that I think are useful to understand. You know, one is that water is an important resource here in the western United States because we experience seasonal drought every year. And what's happened in fire suppression is that we've increased the stand density, so the number of individual trees within stands has gone up. And so that increases competition for water as a resource in the forest itself. Water flows into our rivers and streams have decreased to some degree because of density of the stands and the competition for water from those stands.
Oh, interesting.
And that's accounting for potential changes in precipitation as well?
Yes. And so there's some linkage there between the amount of water that vegetation consumes versus what's available for human consumption. So that's a connection. And then there's also a connection, particularly we see this in Southern California quite a bit, that once these hillsides are denuded of vegetation, water tends to flow off it in rivers. And so you see an increase of and a deluge of water coming off these hillsides because the vegetation is no longer there to retain it. And the soils are fried, and so the water doesn't penetrate and it runs off the surface. And so you get these debris flows that bring massive amounts of soil into reservoirs. So there is some impact in terms of fire intensity and the way in which landscapes burn that does impact the hydrologic cycle, but that's not related to policy.
Okay.
So with policy, so should we be thinking about policies to try to get us back to where we were, say, 100 years ago? Or should we say this is the new norm and we should be moving on with whatever this new normal is?
Yeah, I think this really gets to the choices that we have to make. We often think about the historic look at what our forest, the regimes that our forest experienced in the past. And I think from a policy standpoint, we should be more focused on what we want to do in the future, that those conditions that existed in the past are that they're useful for us to understand, but they're not necessarily going to be, shouldn't be our guideposts moving forward.
Sure.
And so I think the choices that we have to make as a society, understanding that fire is a natural phenomena, it's going to visit these landscapes whether or not we want it to or not, and that we need to make choices about how we want to accommodate fire on the landscape and how we're going to live with it on the landscape, and distinguish between the very necessary thing of protecting structures and homes, you know, in terms of the urban areas that we live, the developed mm-hmm. areas that we lived, and distinguish that from the wildlands, where we have to have a different mindset for how we deal with fire. And I think we sometimes confuse those. And again, the suppression response is about we think we can put out those fires, but we're really not putting them out. We're just delaying them. The Forest Service has taken a different approach and begun to work with communities to address these issues and try to achieve a greater consensus. For example, I was involved with an effort down in Ashland, Oregon. We had a good deal of conflict between the Forest Service and environmental organizations in the community of Ashland about managing fire in the Ashland watershed, which is a municipal watershed. The city of Ashland gets its water from the Ashland watershed. And the Forest Service was focused on creating a system of fuel breaks on ridgetops to compartmentalize the watershed to prevent fire starting in one part of the watershed from moving to another. And environmental organizations were concerned because this area is also designated for habitat for spotted owls and other late successional species. And so creating fuel breaks, these 200 to 350 foot wide fuel breaks, would remove a lot of old growth trees and a lot of old growth habitat. And so there was a stalemate, litigation, lawsuits, protests that occurred. And so I was part of a group of citizens as well as educators that were trying to work to build some bridges between what the Forest Service wanted to do and some of the disagreement in community. And so it took us about 10 years, almost a decade of working with the Forest Service. What emerged over a decade of community work was what's called the Ashland Forestry Resiliency Project, which is a landscape-level treatment that rather than sort of focusing on compartmentalizing the watershed, focuses on making the landscape more resilient to a large-scale wildfire. So again, focusing more on the smaller trees across a wider landscape, removing the ladder fuels, removing the fuels on the forest floor, reintroduction of fire in certain areas, intensive fuel management in other areas, particularly adjacent to the city. And so it's possible for active management to occur, but it requires sort of a different mindset from the Forest Service and others to be willing to sort of work on this problem together.
It sounds like we need foresters with some humanities courses under their belt. Would you agree with that, Bill?
A liberal arts approach, too. Another good example, I'd say, is the Flagstaff Fire Department in Flagstaff, Arizona. They will come out, clear your land, and burn it for you at no cost. And so they're very proactively, as a municipal fire department, in addressing the wildland fire fuels. And they also do prescribed burning on people's properties. And so you have examples of municipal fire departments being very progressive in addressing the wildland fuels problem.
Are they? Do they call themselves like Fahrenheit 450 or something?
Yeah. No, but they do have a wildland division within a municipal fire department. Hmm.
It seems like it can be really effective long term, but perhaps politically more complicated to be proactive that way. We tend to be more reactive towards these kinds of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the crisis response is a natural one for us. The proactive approach is a lot more difficult. I mean, when the fire is over the hill in the distance, you have to respond.
Sure.
When it's not there, you know, you can ignore it and go on to different things.
I don't know if this is our last question or what, but this has been a good conversation. But I grew up knowing very well who Smokey the Bear was. I saw those commercials during cartoons. And then later in my lifetime, Smokey the Bear came under a fair amount of criticism for contributing to this problem of the buildup of fuels. So what do you think, Bill? Smokey the Bear, good, bad, mixed?
Smokey's a very important and interesting point of reference for us in this whole debate. I think, on the whole, the idea that we should prevent human-caused ignitions, random human-caused ignitions on the landscape is a very worthwhile goal. And Smokey is, as you know, wholeheartedly in support of that. So I think the goal of fire in terms of preventing random ignitions on the landscape is an important and useful goal. The downside of that is that people have come to understand or to think of Smokey the Bear and fire as the killer of Bambi, that fire is a bad thing on the landscape and that it's unnatural, particularly many of us that grew up in the era of successful fire suppression, where we didn't see wildfire on a constant basis, felt that that was true, that fire could be controlled and suppressed and that it was a bad thing on the landscape when it happened. And so I think Smokey in that way has contributed to a misunderstanding of the role of fire in our ecosystem and a misunderstanding to the capability of us to prevent it as a disturbance agent on the landscape. I think many people think when they see a fire that we should just get up there and put it out like we do when the neighbor's house catches fire. They don't necessarily understand that we can't do that, that fires to some degree are beyond our control. So I think that has created a challenge and a public information problem to how we communicate both on the one hand the need to prevent random ignitions and on the other hand the need to understand that fire has a natural role to play and is useful for us in obtaining the resources that we want to see on the landscape.
Nuance.
Yeah. Speaking of nuance, this was a very nuanced discussion and we thank you, Bill, for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rodi Ortega wrote our theme music. Like us on Facebook and see what we're up to. If you have a question that you would like us to address on the show in a future episode, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. Subscribe to this podcast and you will automatically download the latest episode as soon as it becomes available. While there, you should leave a comment and a rating. That'll help other people find our podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.